politics season well underway. I had a candidate come to my house this week and knock on my door, and I got to be honest, I don't plan on voting for this candidate, but seeing them there in the flesh and being so really nice, it felt really awkward. So I opened the door and, hey, can I count on your vote? And I was like, oh my goodness, how do you say no? I was just kind of like, listen, it's not you, it's me. I have some issues and personal hang-ups, so I just might need to, I can't make that kind of commitment right now. It was an awkward exchange because I don't like conflict, and so I just had to try to get out of there. But they're very precise, eh, with their, can I count on your vote? But we're right in the middle of election season, and of course, we're going through the series, Politics and Power, through the lens of art and scripture. So I thought, what better time than to showcase this next piece of art? This piece is by William Hogarth. It's entitled An Election Entertainment. And it was part of his Humors of an Election Art series, which showcased the endemic corruption of parliamentary elections at the time. And if you get the chance to check this out on like your home computer or something, take a look, because it's hilarious. There's so many little details in it that are hard to notice from far away. But the artwork was created when England was still fairly young in its infancy of democracy. And after the English Parliament had succeeded in restricting the rights of the monarch, elections to the House of Commons became increasingly important. But ballots at the time were not secret. And so people knew who you were voting for. And candidates fought for votes with every means at their disposal. Bribery, fear-mongering, intimidation, fraud. I'm not making any commentary. Anyway, this piece was created in 1775, and as you might notice, it's not a flattering image of democracy. The piece is a biting satire on the chaotic conditions of democracy in its infancy. And so it shows us a dinner happening in a tavern. The representatives are the host party representatives. They're seated on the left there. And if you look close, hey, it worked. This politician here is getting a bribe, but this guy up here is trying to light his wig on fire. And you've got the picture of the monarch up there slashed while these men vie for power. Outside, the demonstrators out here are throwing rocks inside, and this guy got hit in the head by one of them. At the same time, they're actually protesting against Lord Hartwig's Marriage Act. So when I found this, because I've done a paper on that Marriage Act, I was very excited. We'll get to that later this season. But this guy's here dumping water or urine on them. I can't quite tell exactly what's going on there. And this politician is so stuffed up on oysters, he's being bled of his gluttony for food and power. Again, not exactly the most flattering image of democracy. See, during the time, the rules of democracy had been written, but they weren't followed. In London, seats in Parliament were often openly put up for sale. And during that century, prices for a seat in the House ran you about £5,000. Money you could easily make back once you got into power. And so the candidates could buy their seat into the House. They could also blatantly buy votes. Then once inside the House of Parliament, they could then count on having their own vote bought as well. Robert Walpole, for many years, he was the British Prime Minister, he once said, every man in the House of Commons has his price. Bribes were generally an accepted tool at the time. In fact, in the words of one of the members of Parliament, he said, I have heard many speeches in the House of Commons which have changed my views, but none that have influenced my vote. Oh my. For William Hogarth, the scene of early democracy in England was just brutal, corrupt. His art, you could say, echoes the words of Frank Herbert, a deft disturber of the peace, I might say. All governments suffer a recurring problem. Power attracts pathological personalities. It's not that power corrupts, but that it's magnetic to the corruptible. And this is what his piece of art seems to capture here in this work of satire. Looking at early democracy, he could only conclude politics was a dirty business, rather cheap entertainment. And as we pick up our survey of the Old Testament, we come to a crossroads in the story of Israel, and they are at a moment where they have decided we want in on the political game. They want in on the politics of their day and time. And so last week, you'll remember, the period of the judges left an ache in the hearts of the Hebrew people. They've been bullied. They've been oppressed from every side. Despite temporary moments of peace, any victory the judges had won seemed to be short-lived. There was an appetite for change, for progress going forward. They wanted to choose forward. They felt it was time to get ahead. They craved someone in power who would be in it for them. They didn't want to go left or right. They wanted to go forward together. They just wanted to be strong and free. It's okay, I made fun of them all, right? So candidates could buy their seat in the House. Sorry, well, I'm blacking out here. So the period of the judges has come to an end, and all of a sudden, Israel finds themselves ready to move forward. They've been slaves in Egypt, slaves there. They've been liberated from oppression, and then they journeyed back to the historic land of their ancestors. They wanted to make a home for themselves. And repeatedly, what we see throughout the Old Testament is we get this sense that God wants their path as a people to be different from all the other nations around them. And so God brings these slaves out of Egypt and gives them a new vision for how to be a people. And essentially, it boiled down to this: don't become another Egypt. Don't become another nation, a tribe that will oppress people, enslave people. Your job, Israel, your calling, your destiny is to be a new kind of nation. Unlike every other nation, you're to be a blessing to others. Unlike the others, you're to be a place of refuge for the widow, the orphan, the foreigner. A radical idea at the time, I suppose it still is. But in those times, the normal role of a tribe was to what? Conquer, build yourself up, stay alive, protect your assets, build up your army so that you can conquer and dominate. But God says, that's not the path, that's not the storyline I have for you. You're to be a tribe that's not going to be driven by greed and violence and fear. But as we know, that call for them has not been easy. In fact, it's been quite brutal. Bullied, harassed. They decide, we've got to play the politics of our day. And so they start looking around. That tribe is stronger than us. That tribe's more successful than us. That tribe's superior to us. We don't like our story, our path anymore. We want what they have. And what they have that we don't is a king. And remember, we're in Babylon here. These stories are being crafted and written and told. You're reflecting on how did we end up here in exile again? And the story becomes a focal point for where things really started to go downhill. So we pick up the story of the nation as a tribe being led and guided by a prophet named Samuel. Then this happens, 1 Samuel 8. All of the elders of Israel gathered together came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, you are old, and your sons do not follow your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have. But when they said, give us a king to lead us, this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord, and the Lord told him, listen to all that the people are saying to you. It's not you they've rejected, but they have rejected me as their king. As they have done from the day I brought them out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you. Now listen to them, but warn them solemnly and let them know what the king who will reign over them will claim as his rights. And so they've been given this vision for being a different kind of nation, a different kind of people. God's given them their own unique story and path, but it's been tough, so they're done with it. Just want to play like everybody else. God says, fine, just let them have a king. Don't want to force people into anything. If they're not ready for it, okay, but warn them what this is going to look like. So Samuel passed on the Lord's warning to the people who were asking him for a king. This is how a king will reign over you, Samuel said. The king will draft your sons and assign them to his chariots and his charioteers. making them run before his chariots. Some will be generals and captains in his army. Some will be forced to plow in his fields and harvest his crops. Some will make his weapons and chariot equipment. The king will take your daughters from you and force them to cook and bake and make perfumes for him. He will take away the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his own officials. He'll take a tenth of your grain and your grape harvest and distribute it among his officers and attendants. He will take your male and female slaves and demand the finest of your cattle and donkeys for his own use. He'll demand a tenth of your flocks, and you will be his slaves. In a sense, this is pretty standard governmental fare going on here. King's going to feed the war machine, going to tax you, and generally it's the top 1% that will benefit from that. Doesn't sound that different. But there's a loaded term here in this warning. God says they will be made slaves to the political system of the day. Now, that should be a red flag to any of us because their whole story is about being slaves who were freed. They had been rescued from slavery. That was core to their identity, fundamental part of who they had been. Now they were free to become a different kind of people. And God says, well, you're simply going to become slaves again. And they say, well, who cares? That's what we want. This decision will only make them slaves again, but the people refused to listen to Samuel's warning. Even so, we still want a king, they said. We want to be like the nations around us. Our king will judge us and lead us into battle. So Samuel repeated to the Lord what the people had said. The Lord replied, do as they say, give them a king. Samuel agreed and sent the people home. They want to be just like the others. And God says, fine. But remember, when you want what others have, and when you diverge from the path you've been called to, when you try to live someone else's story, it makes you its slave. And God tries to warn them. You might think you want the safety and security and all the benefits that might come from having a king, but you're living someone else's story, and when that happens, it's going to rob you of your life, because when we try to live by someone else's story, it makes us its slave. One of the most beautiful things to me about marriage is two people become one. They share all of life together, and so when Kristen and I got married, it meant that she not only got this, she inherited my school debt as well, which was substantial. I do, boom. Welcome to thousands of debt, honey. She had managed to get through school without debt. Me, not so much. And then things in our first year of marriage only got worse because she wasn't working. She was going to teacher's college. I was working part-time, and we weren't covering the bills at all. So debt went higher. Got in a car accident. I mean, it was bad. Year two, we were like, whoa, we need to just take a look at the plan here. And so we sat down, we thought, wow, we're in this pretty deep, and we made ourselves a little plan. 4 to 6 years it would take us to get out of debt, depending on how aggressive we were. And we were excited. We can do this. We didn't have much at the time. It's still a point of pride for me. Our apartment was furnished with lawn chairs we had received at our wedding. And I don't ever remember asking for a lawn chair on our registry, but we got 11 of them. It was a little strange. 11 lawn chairs. So please, come in, welcome. We were so excited, ready to go. We can do this together. Now, remember well, though, we were part of this small group for couples who had married less than 2 years. And it was a good group. We had fun, but one particular evening, we were like, we're going to talk this evening about finances. I'm like, okay, that'll be good. We'll be all in this together. And so we got together, and everyone started sharing, and one couple shared about how they felt so blessed because as their wedding gift, their parents had paid off their school debt for them. Another couple, early on, entrepreneurs, young in business, they were doing so well. They were buying a house. Another couple, they were broke. Neither of them had jobs, but their grandmother decided to give them a house. Just, there you go, house for you. Another couple was excited. We feel so blessed. We had full scholarships. We were completely debt-free right now. And when it was our turn to share, it was like, we feel blessed that we have this debt as an opportunity for growth. And I remember we left the meeting and we got in the car and it was like complain fest. We were fired up, Chris and I. Who gives somebody a house? That's insane. Who just gets a house? Whose parents pay off their school debt? We were complaining. Grr, just so angry. I want their story to be my story. That way, the story they have seems way easier than mine, and we just kept complaining. How come our parents were broke and didn't help us, or how come we have awful grandparents, or so? I don't know. It was just, But the bizarre thing to me was this. In that moment, absolutely nothing had changed. We had our plan, and we had a peace with our debt. And the moment we heard somebody else's story and how it compared to ours, suddenly everything shifted. At that moment, we looked around at other people's stories and said, I want that. Instantly envious of somebody else's path. 5 minutes before, excited about our future. 5 minutes after the meeting, I hate my life. This sucks. But nothing had changed. For Israel, the era of the kings was the beginning of the end of their story. It would lead to their exile, permanent dispersion of 10 of their 12 tribes. They would never be the same after this decision. And it all started when they knew what their own path and story was, and they decided to compare that to others and ended up thinking this is too hard. It all started when they looked around, compared themselves, and said, nope, we don't like our story. We'll pursue that one. And in that, that's why these stories, I love them, because you go deep enough into them and they're like a mirror to your soul, right? Because like them, we are forever comparing, constantly, making judgments. Where do I stand in the pecking order of life? I think there's just a really big part of us, right, that wants to know that we're better than others. We have it better than others, have maybe the better story, the better life. Traveling down that road never ends well. Tom DeLonge, a great book, author of Flying Without a Net, he describes what he calls the comparing trap. He writes this, no matter how successful we are and how many goals we achieve, this trap causes us to recalibrate our accomplishments and reset the bar for how we define success. When we judge the entirety of our own lives against the top 1% of our friends' lives, we're setting impossible standards for ourselves, making us more miserable than ever. I think it's true. We make ourselves miserable comparing our lives to others, comparing our stories to others. It's almost like we're infected with this disease of unhealthy competitiveness and comparison. And I think it charges our relationships a lot of times with jealousy, comparison. Because it becomes incredibly hard, right, to love others when achievements are cause for jealousy or resentment. I think we love and work to truly see others as equals, but then when people are talented or they got achievement or a seemingly better story, it can actually feel like a bit of a threat to us. It doesn't enhance us as it should. It sort of feels like a threat. Our self-confidence can feel down when others outscore us in life, and our ego becomes inflated when it seems like we're doing superior things to others. And at the end of the day, what we find is that measuring ourselves, it ends up making us its slave. And of course, it doesn't mean that there isn't legitimate things to grieve in life, things that are genuinely difficult. It doesn't mean that we don't name and identify those, but it does mean this, when we live our lives wanting someone else's story, we miss the ways God is calling us into our own stories. And as I've reflected on this, jealousy is something I really struggle with in multitude of ways. I find myself constantly sort of, where do I measure up to others? How am I doing? And struggling. I mean, have you ever had this happen? Someone in life shares with you their good news and it becomes your bad news, right? We're engaged. Crap, I lose. Or I got a new job, it pays six figures, it's at Google, I get to play ping pong and they feed me all my meals and you're like, I hate my job. Hate it. Someone say, I'm traveling to Europe for 6 weeks this summer, and you're like, my little weekend in Bob Cajun doesn't feel so cool anymore, right? Ugh, my life is not exciting. Or maybe it's, we're pregnant. It's like, oh, cool, congrats, great, we've been trying for years to get pregnant, so that's great, yep. Yeah, I'd love to go to the baby shower where everyone holds babies and does crazy baby games, and that's not a reminder at all to me that this has been a struggle and deep pain. So often other people's good news, right, becomes our bad news because we're sort of, we've got this comparison thing going on. I mean, have you ever had that show up and you're like, woo, what is that in me? Or what about this? Have you ever had someone's bad news become your good news? I remember I was at a fair with Steve. I know he's over with the kids this morning, and Steve's a problematic guy because he's always goading me, and there was this climbing rock wall. He's like, hey, let's go and race up it, and I'm like, Steve, you're 8 feet tall. Like, this just doesn't seem like a fair competition, but he kept goading me. Come on, let's go. It's going to be a race. Fine, put the little harness on, and 1, 2, 3, go. We started racing up the wall. I'm losing, but he fell. Poof, hanging from the rope, and I climbed to the top, and I was just like, yes, eat it, like, yes. And in that moment, that competition climbing with Steve, it felt to me like this bizarre illustration of all that is very dark within me. I mean, have you ever had something bad happen to someone and it just lights you up in a way and you're like, what is that? If you've ever had that happen, you know exactly what sin is. That's sin. It's like, someone might be like, oh, I lost my job. You're like, oh, that's too bad. But in your head, you're like, looks good on you. I'm the only one? Oh, man. Or someone says, you know, my relationship it's not working real well right now. And you're like, sweet, mine is. Somewhere in like this shadow self of us, it's like when we hear people's bad news, sometimes it feels like we're winning in the game of life. I don't know about you, but have you ever had those moments? They're dark, and the thing is, nobody knows. It's all up here. You say the right things. That's too bad. And I think it's one of the reasons why we hate to be vulnerable, right? We know the game's going on in our own mind, so being vulnerable with other people is tough because we know. I have a good friend, and for years it was interesting. I was always kind of intrigued because he would never talk about his marriage, and I don't want to pry, and with guys a lot of times that stuff doesn't even come up, but I remember the time we were driving together. He said, listen, I just got to tell you something. My wife wants to leave me right now. There's this moment of silence, and he said, I have felt like I can't tell anyone this because I feel like such a loser. And just vocalizing that makes me feel like I'm just losing at everything in life. And I don't know, but I've got to be honest. I've got a number of great friends. There is an absolute life vitality to having relationships where you know you can be vulnerable and you're not going to be met with any sort of hint of you're losing at life. And it's hard to be weak or struggling with others because so often we're consumed by this game of life where we're the only ones who know the rules. We spend all of our time comparing ourselves to others, measuring, keeping score, and yet we find we're never winning because there's always somebody who's doing just a little bit better, right? I think we create our own personal hells when we can never know true friendship, true community. And if we don't kill that beast inside of us, always looking around to see if somebody else's story's better than ours, that comparison trap, if we don't kill that, it means a life of poverty in terms of our relationships with others. The comparison trap is a soul-sucking game. It will make you its slave. derails you from your true path and calling in life. It kills our joy. There's no joy when we're always comparing ourselves. It robs us of gratitude, because when somebody else has something better, it's hard to be thankful for what you do have. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that this is not just an individual thing, it can be a collective thing as well. It could be something churches struggle with. You know, I think we can spend our time in churches a lot of times thinking that we wished it looked like another church. And I think, why doesn't Brad talk more about the things that my favorite podcast author person talks about? Or why doesn't our music sound more like church music? Or why doesn't Nexus have programs that look like normal church programs? Or why don't we do more of this together as a church? Why don't we structure ourselves more like the churches I've read about in those books where it always sounds like they're super successful? Why do we do that stupid summer thing? Why do we do this? You know, like, it can eat away at us. Always sort of going, if we were a little bit more like that, things would be better. A little bit more like that. Comparing. We have to be okay with our church as it is, because we, as a group, have a particular calling and story here. You, as an individual, have a particular calling and story. I heard a wonderful saying one time. It was this: if you don't love the church you have, it will become the enemy of the one you want. And I agree. It's easy to get into that trap of wishing things were different. And of course, it doesn't mean, I'm not trying to say we don't have a lot of ways to grow here at Nexus. Of course we do. But if you don't love what you have, it'll become the enemy of what you want, and it's true personally as well. If you don't love the life, the path, the story you have been given, it will become the enemy of the one you wish you had. And this is precisely the problem that we see in the early story of Israel. They didn't love the path and story God was calling them to. Instead, they fell in love with the political systems of the day. If we were just more like that, with a king, we could build an empire and have power, protect ourselves. And so they chose, you know what, we're done with our story. We're going this way. And it would spell their doom. Suffer under so many awful monarchs. They would find themselves embroiled in civil war, overthrown, led away into exile, and as they're sitting in exile going, how did we get here? They would tell themselves this story. Remember when we didn't like our story? We didn't like the path God had set out for us, and we wanted a king. Yeah, maybe that's how we ended up here. If only we hadn't compared ourselves to those nations around us. If only, if only, if only. And the story becomes a mirror, it becomes a caution. If you don't love the path, the life, the story we've given, you'll become the enemy of the one you wish you had, because when you try to live by someone else's story, it makes you its slave. And so the question, as we close this morning for all of us, I think is simply this: who am I here to be? Who are you here to be? What is your path? What is it that God's calling you to? What does it mean to be truly yourself? We can only ever answer that when we stop placing our stories alongside others.